Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. Today is a very special edition of the Inside Scoop because I'm going to be playing a full-on one-hour debate without commercial interruption between 27-year-old John Kerry and 25-year-old John O'Neill. The debate occurred 33 years ago on June 30th, 1971, on The Dick Cavett Show. It is a debate on the Vietnam War. What the debate is a very interesting look back into history, certainly, and into the period of time when America was probably even more divided than it is today, a look back at the Vietnam War. But it's also striking, really, in the issues that it has for today. It gives us a very good insight, I think, into the character of John Kerry, the man who I believe will be the next president of the United States, and also into the character of John O'Neill, one of his really harshest detractors, his nemesis, if you will. And it's kind of interesting watching these heavyweights go at it in their 20s. Now, I'm sure you know who John Kerry is. You may not recall who John O'Neill is. John O'Neill is the author of Unfit for Command, a book, really a pretty vicious screed against John Kerry. And he and his organization, which is called Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, basically accuses John Kerry of fabricating all of his heroic stories. He did not earn a single medal. He did not undergo gunfire. According to John O'Neill in his book, the whole story of him saving, John Kerry saving Jim Rastman under fire, saving the man's life, is all a fabrication. And we've seen in recent times the story begin to unravel. We've seen, in fact, Lieutenant Commander George Elliott has gone back and forth on his affidavit, changing his mind several times, admitting that he never saw anything, and in fact that signing an affidavit for this group was a terrible mistake. We've seen a doctor who claims to have treated Kerry, but his records are nowhere to be found. We have Kerry's medical records, but this doctor's name isn't on them. We have a whole host of men who claim to have served with John Kerry, and none of them were on his boat. And then, just Thursday, it came out that one of these Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, who swore on an affidavit that Kerry was not under fire when he saved Jim Rastman's life, that, in fact, he was asked, Lester Thurlow, if someone said they were under fire, what would that be? Well, you know, could that possibly be true? And he said, no, that was a total fabrication. Well, the Washington Post went and got Lester Thurlow's own military records under the Freedom of Information Act, and they show that about 35 years ago, even Thurlow's records show that all five boats were under fire. So, were they telling the truth 10 days after the event occurred, or is Thurlow correct 35 years later, and they were wrong 10 days earlier? And if so, why didn't Lester Thurlow throw away his medals? His medals were also based on the fact that they were being shot at. What's interesting, and what's going to be interesting when we look at this video, which is 33 years ago, when we listen to it on the radio, is not the fact that the Swift Boat veterans are not telling the truth. I think that's coming clear and clear in the press. What's interesting is you listen to the really caged hostility of John O'Neill towards John Kerry. This is a guy who's very upset. He's not upset that John Kerry has pretended to be a hero. In fact, in this entire hour of debate, there's absolutely no mention of any allegation that John Kerry fabricated his record. This is, of course, the allegation they're bringing 35 years later, claiming John Kerry's a liar. Way back when, in 1971, when just a few months after these things happened, there's absolutely no allegation by John O'Neill that John Kerry lied at all. No, he is angry at John Kerry for a different reason. He's angry at John Kerry because John Kerry came back from Vietnam and then oppose the war. And he's extremely angry at John Kerry for saying that many Americans committed war crimes, committed some atrocities, that even John Kerry himself has committed what he called war crimes. Now, this tape is one that the Republicans are using, have used, will continue to use. And taken out of context, they're going to say, and I've already heard them say, John Kerry admits to have committed war crimes. Do you want to elect this guy? That's why I felt it was important for you folks to hear the entire tape, unedited. There'll be a few comments by me in between the tape, but you're going to hear the entire tape because it really puts the entire thing into context. It understands what John Kerry was talking about. He was talking about the fact that people, his higher-ups, had ordered him to do things that, according to the Geneva Convention, were war crimes, but that he fought both within and without the military because he didn't feel that those things were proper. And we're going to go through, and I'm going to go through and explain some things as we go along, but I want to get right to the tape. The last thing to say, though, is that John O'Neill has a co-author. His co-author of his book is Jerome Corsi. We can dismiss Jerome Corsi. Jerome Corsi is a right-wing nutcase. Jerome Corsi is someone who has admitted quite freely he hates gay people, he hates Jewish people. He's called Hillary Clinton a lesbo. He said Bill Clinton is un-American. He's called John Kerry a communist. And he really doesn't like Catholics. He said, and this is a direct quote from Jerome Corsi, "So this is what the last days of the Catholic Church are going to look like. Buggering boys undermines the moral base, and the lawyers rip the gold off the Vatican altars. We may get one more pope when this senile old one dies, but that's probably about it," unquote. So Jerome Corsi, I think, is fair to dismiss as a right-wing nutcase. But John O'Neill, he's not so easy to dismiss. He is a veteran. He passionately believes in what he has to say, and I think he's quite articulate. But listen beneath the strange politeness that we still had in 1971 when people were debating each other. Listen to how he always makes the attack personal. Kerry always tries to elevate the debate to discuss the issues. John O'Neill is always going for the jugular. And it's fascinating to see that this man, who went for the jugular 33 years ago, is still going for the jugular today. Let's listen to the Dick Cavett Show 33 years ago. One last thing, you're always welcome to comment. There are no commercials, but there will be time for your calls. Call in. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Or as always, you can give a comment on the blog. Just go to the blog, www.radioinsidescoop.com, say what you like, and we'll mention some of your comments on air. I give you the Dick Cavett Show.
The Dick Cavett Show. Tonight, Dick's guests are John Kerry from Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
This is John O'Neill, this is John Kerry, and I even think that we both asked you which profiles you favor. They're equally. See, we will actually start, because it was requested that we do this. This may seem ludicrous, with the flip of a coin, because this is not going to follow the actual outlines of the debate, but I thought it might be well for each of you fellows to start out with some statement of what your organization wants and is, if you'd like to do that. You want to call it in the air?
Yes.
All right, it's an absolute, it's a U.S. quarter, 1966. Okay. One. You got it.
I'll speak first.
Okay.
The person speaking first is John O'Neill.
Come here today to speak for peace, a just and lasting peace in Southeast Asia. There is no one in this country who likes war, least of all those of us who fought in the Vietnam War. And it is in the spirit of ending that war in a rational manner that I would like to speak today. I think any rational man can see that the Vietnamization program of the president has done more to end this war than all the demonstrations and hate of the last 10 years in this country. When Mr. Kerry and I were in Vietnam, there were 550,000 U.S. troops there. When Mr. Kerry marched down in April with his 900 embittered men to Washington, there were 284,000 troops there. When our own organization was formed in May, there were 245,000 troops there. Today, there are 215,000, and by the time you see this show tonight, there will be 700 less. When we were in Vietnam, there were 87,000 Marines in I Corps. Today, there are 900 in all of South Vietnam, and South Vietnam and I Corps remain free. The unit we both served in Vietnam, Coastal Division 11, the first naval combat unit in Vietnam, was one of the last naval combat units out of Vietnam last December. And the South Vietnamese who replaced us there are doing a fine job. They have won victories and they've suffered defeats, as any army does. But the main story has been that the strength of the North Vietnamese in I Corps and other areas of that country, including the Mekong Delta, where we both serve, has been broken. I think there are three things that we can all agree on. First, we all want to see a speedy end to American involvement in Vietnam. Second, we all realize that if we come home from Vietnam, leaving our POWs in rotting in North Vietnamese jails, that we will leave the heart and soul of this country there also. Finally, we all want to see the South Vietnamese have the type of government that they themselves freely choose. I suggest that it's time for an end to hate and disruption in this country. I suggest it's time for trust in this country, the same kind of trust that we will need when the war in Vietnam is over to live with ourselves here. I'd like to turn to a second issue. Mr. Kerry is the type of person who lives and survives only on the war weariness and fears of the American people. This is the same little man who on nationwide television in April spoke of, quote, crimes committed on a day-to-day basis with a full awareness of officers at all levels of command, who was quoted in a prominent news magazine in May as saying, quote, war crimes in Vietnam are the rule and not the exception, unquote, who brought 50 veterans down to Washington to testify about alleged atrocities in April. The same 50 who, after they had appeared on every major news network, refused to provide any depositions or provide any details of any kind. Never in the course of human events have so many been libeled by so few. There were 2.5 million of us who served there in Vietnam. Under the most severe restrictions in this nation's history, we have brought this war close to a close. We never engaged in mass bombing of population centers, as all nations did in World War II. And the reason we did not is because we are a moral people. 55,000 Americans died there in Vietnam, no matter what they thought about the war, because they believed in this country. And those of us who survived came back to this country, by and large determined just to resume our normal lives after the disruption caused by war. We encountered a variety of problems, unemployment, discrimination, other problems. And then we encountered the biggest problem of them all, the big lie by Mr. Kerry and his group, that we were either each individually war criminals or that we were collectively the executioners of a criminal policy. You've seen that all before. It's guilt by association. If one or 50 or 150 veterans testify as to war crimes, then all 2.5 million of us must be war criminals. That's the same as saying if one Jew or one black commits one murder in this country, then all the Jews and all the blacks in this country must be murderers, and that is something that we must not stand for in this country. We've all heard of Lieutenant Calley. He's accused of the murder of 102 civilians at Song My Lai, and the operation and the law will operate in his case. This man has attempted the murder of the reputations of 2.5 million of us, including the 55,000 dead in Vietnam, and he will never be brought to justice. We can only seek justice and equity from the American people. Every man kills the thing he loves. By each, let this be told. The brave man does it with a sword, the coward with a word. Thank you.
Mr. Kerry, I expect you have something to say to that. We have a message, however. Calgon here is now how a bath can smooth and soften your skin, leave you radiant and refreshed with Calgon Bath Oil B.
Well, as Dick Cavett goes to a commercial, I want to make some comments here. First of all, I think it was a little extraordinary to have him talk about Calgon after that attack. Let's first of all give a little history here. I think it's important to understand the history of what's going on. First of all, what's going on? It's now 1971. Richard Nixon is president of the United States. The war in Vietnam has already been conceded, interestingly enough, as lost by both sides, both those in support of the war and those against the war. You heard from John O'Neill. He wants the troops out. He wants a speedy end. Now, that obviously is 1971. Remember the context in which this debate occurs. It wasn't occurring in 68, 69, in 65, back when we thought we could win the war. Everyone agrees that we've lost the war and it's time to leave the troops, to have the troops get out. Well, John Kerry basically says, get out now. What John O'Neill says is he supports Vietnamization. Now, Vietnamization was Richard Nixon's plan to basically let South Vietnam take over for American troops. Sound familiar? Sound like Iraqification? In other words, it's exactly the same thing that George Bush is trying to do in Iraq. Let the locals take over. Of course, it's a failure. One of the reasons it's a failure is because South Vietnam has a dictatorship. The people, in fact, are more supportive of the North Vietnamese communist dictatorship than they are of the United States-backed South Vietnamese dictatorship. But I think it's important to know the context of how they're talking. It's also important to note that John O'Neill is very articulate. He's a good speaker. He's very powerful in his debate. But note how he gets personal. He calls John Kerry the same little man that does such and such. And basically what he's most angry about, more than anything, is not that he claims that John Kerry fabricated anything with his heroism. He doesn't. He doesn't make that claim in 1971. That claim would have to wait 33 more years. No, he makes a claim that, what makes him so angry is that John Kerry is accusing everyone of war crimes, which after all is a pretty serious charge. He does mention Lieutenant Calley, and you're going to hear that name throughout the debate. Lieutenant Calley was found guilty of massacring large numbers of Vietnamese in the My Lai Massacre. My Lai is a place in Vietnam. Basically, Lieutenant Calley, you can say he went crazy. For whatever reason, he went and massacred men, women, and children who were not holding weapons in Vietnam. So if you hear Calley or things like Calley, think of massacre. Think of the My Lai Massacre. This is someone who John O'Neill is saying is not representative of the troops, and so please don't call them all Calleys. Again, quite a strong charge. We've heard Dick Cavett, I think, embarrassingly talk about Calgon in the middle of all this. Now let's hear John Kerry's response.
Before that break, and I must apologize for the fact that we do have to keep stopping commercial medium, and sometimes those things aren't going to mesh very well. John Kerry.
Wow. Well, there's so many things really to be said, and it's hard to find a place to start after a barrage like that. I think, first of all, I'm somewhat surprised at the attitude of somebody who wore the same uniform as I did and served in the same military for the same kind, I hope, patriotic reasons. And I really haven't come back to this country, nor have Vietnam veterans against the war come back to this country to try in any sense or in any form to show bitterness or to tear the country apart or to tear it down. I think that what we're doing is we're trying in a sense to show where the country went wrong. And we believe that as veterans who took part in this war, we have nothing to gain by coming back here and talking about those things that have happened, except to try and point the way to America, to try and say, here is where we went wrong, and we've got to change. And I think that the attitude of the Vietnam veterans for a just peace is really one sort of my country, right or wrong, which is really on the intellectual level, I think, of saying my mother, drunk or sober. And I think that just as when your mother is drunk, you take her and dry her out, God forbid that she is, You take your country, in the words of Senator Carl Schurz, who said, my country, right or wrong, when right, keep it right, when wrong, put it right. And I think that that's what we veterans are trying to do. On the question of Vietnamization, this is something which people can argue about for hours and hours. We've just heard it mentioned that it's succeeding, that the Marines have been withdrawn from the North. Well, just the other day, Fire Base Fuller was overrun, and it took the United States to fly supplies in to take care of it. We hear that the Delta is pacified. Well, a few weeks ago, the report came out that 54 naval bases and other bases, all the bases in the Delta, had been overrun in the first 3 months of 1971, and that the reason they were overrun was because in 22 cases, sentries were asleep. In 22 cases, there were quislings, people who gave up. You can contest this question of Vietnamization right down the line. The question really is this. Is the United States of America determined to leave Vietnam? And if we are determined to leave Vietnam, which I believe the president has shown some indications of, because he has withdrawn troops, we don't deny that. What we say is the troops can be withdrawn faster. What we say is the killing can stop tomorrow. And it can stop if the president of the United States will set a date certain for the withdrawal of all United States combat and advisory troops from South Vietnam. And that's really the major issue. Now, on the question of war crimes, it's really only with the utmost consideration that we pose this question. I don't think that any man comes back to this country to say that he raped, or to say that he burnt a village, or to say that he wantonly destroyed crops or something for pleasure. I think he does it at the risk of certain kinds of punishment, at the risks of injuring his own character, which he has to live with, at the risks of the loss of his family and friends as a result of it. And he does it because he believes intensely that people have got to be educated about the devastation of this war. We thought we were a moral country, yes, But we are now engaged in the most rampant bombing in the history of mankind. Since President Nixon has assumed office, we have dropped some 2,700,000 tons of bombs on Laos. That is more than we dropped in the entire Pacific and Atlantic theaters in the entire course of World War II. And I think the question of morality really has to enter in here. So I'd say that Vietnam veterans against the war are really trying to approach this from a most constructive point of view.
You were both actually there, each allowed 5 minutes, and you took a little less, but have you finished your opening statement?
No, I'd like to discuss everything possible.
Yeah, right. But now we can both talk, I guess.
I'd like to comment on a number of things. Our attitude certainly isn't our country, right or wrong. We were all 15 and 16 years old. We happened to get into the Vietnam War. What's so interesting about many of Mr. Carey's backers, including Clark Clifford, Roger Hilsman, and a number of others, is that they happen to be exactly the same people who sent us to Vietnam. Well, we certainly, obviously, would never support this country if we felt it were wrong. We just feel we need a rational way out of Vietnam. As far as setting a date, that accomplishes nothing. Finally, Mr. Carey said that he didn't come here to show bitterness. He didn't feel bitter. He said in a statement to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on April 22nd, he said, "We are angry because we feel we have been used in the worst fashion by the administration of this country." A second thing we object to with Mr. Carey's organization is his attempt to represent himself as speaking for all veterans, which he clearly did in the same statement. As far as the 54 bases overrun in the Delta, I can refer him to an article by John Paul Vann in U.S. News and World Report of June 1st, which states that the number of incidents in that area is running about 20 per month, vice 120 per month 2 years ago. I think that clearly the biggest question that we're going to have to deal with is the moral question of war crimes. There's quite a difference between coming back to this country and putting on a sack and saying, confessing, well, I've committed war crimes, and running for the Congress of the United States from Massachusetts and saying, well, all 3 million of us committed war crimes. And I suggest that that's the question that Mr. Carey and I should be talking about, because that's precisely and exactly what he said.
Well, let's talk about that. Did you see war crimes committed, and how do you talk about that?
I've often talked about this subject. I personally didn't see personal atrocities in the sense that I saw somebody cut a head off or something like that. However, I did take part in free fire zones. I did take part in harassment and interdiction fire. I did take part in search and destroy missions in which the houses of non-combatants were burned to the ground. And all of these, I find out later on, these acts are contrary to the Hague and Geneva Conventions and to the laws of warfare. So in that sense, anybody who took part in those, if you carry out the application of the Nuremberg Principles, is in fact guilty. But we're not trying to find war criminals. That's not our purpose. It never has been. I have a letter here which I could read to you, which we wrote to Washington, D.C. in an effort to try and solve the problem of these war crimes. And we sent it to Senator Stennis. And we said, on behalf of Vietnam Veterans Against the War, we're writing to ask the Senate Armed Services Committee immediately convene public hearings to examine the testimony presented by these veterans. And I go on, among the questions raised were charges of. And what we're looking for is an examination of our policy by people in this country, particularly by the leaders, before they take young men who were the objects of that policy and try them, rather than examine the policy at the highest level where it was in fact promulgated.
That's very interesting you say that, John. I have an article right now. It's from the May 8, 1971 New York Times. It concerns some of the testimony. It concerns a Danny S. Notley, who apparently is a member of your organization. The Army pursued him all the way to Minnesota to try and get him to sign a deposition regarding the allegations of war crimes that he made, and he refused to, as have all 50 people that testified there and 150 that testified in Detroit. And so I suggested, if you're honest, you ought to finally produce the depositions after all of us waiting for 2 months. The effect of what you've done hasn't been to prevent one or two carries. It's been to label 2.5 million of us as callies, not carries, although they may be somewhat interchangeable at times. I suggest that the point of the matter is that's precisely and exactly what you've done. And I think in honesty, as a just and decent human being, that you'd want to do that. I think there's something particularly pathetic about me having to appear on nationwide television and trade polished little phrases with you to defend the honor of the 55,000 people that died there, the 2.5 million of us that served there. I think further that the justification that Hanoi uses for keeping our POWs is that they were engaged in criminal acts there. And I think that someone that comes out and says exactly the same thing can be doing nothing but serving those purposes, although I'm not, obviously, those are not your intentions. There's no question about that.
Well, the Vietnam veterans against the war, and I can't even pretend to speak for all of the Vietnam veterans against the war, let alone speak for all the men who served in Vietnam, and neither, in fact, can anybody else pretend to speak for a majority. That's entirely in the impossible reign. But what we're saying is, and the reason that some of these men have not signed depositions is very, very simple, and it's up to each individual. One reason is that specifically they are not looking to implicate other people. They haven't cited names of individuals involved because they don't want more Callies. They don't want men to enter double jeopardy, to have to come back to the United States of America and be penalized for those things that they did that were the result of the mistakes and the bad decisions of their leaders.
I'm going to interrupt here and explain a little bit what's going on. I think most of you are following it, but just in case, let's be clear what we're talking about and how I think it has relevance to today. The question is one over war crimes. And when Kerry John O'Neill brings to Kerry's attention, says, you said we've committed war crimes. This is an insult on the 55,000 veterans. And Kerry points out that we did in Vietnam drop more bombs than all of World War II, and he says that he didn't see personal atrocities. Kerry does not claim to have seen or committed personal atrocities, things like, he says, cutting people's heads off. But he did see free fire zones. A free fire zone is basically where you shoot at anything that moves. He also saw and participated in these zones, was ordered to, and was also ordered to participate in search and destroy missions, basically where you burn the houses of non-combatants completely to the ground. These, he says, he didn't know at the time. That was important. He didn't know it at the time, but he later found out were against the Geneva Conventions, and these are war crimes. Kerry further says it's not his purpose to find war criminals. It's not his job to take the men that have done these things, maybe things not as severe as the My Lai Massacre, but things like free fire zones, following orders to shoot at everything that moves, burning down houses of non-combatants, to do this. It's not his job, Kerry says, to find the war criminals. That's not his job. His job is to find the people above that ordered the war crimes, to find out who ordered these things. And he knows that it's very hard for these young men to sign depositions that they occurred, because what does a deposition mean? You're saying under oath, I committed a war crime. Not many people are going to say that. If you say that, you're basically subjecting yourself to prosecution. Why does all of this matter? Well, think again to what happened in Iraq. Think again to the tortures in Abu Ghraib prison. People were surprised that officers didn't, and enlisted men didn't report what happened in Abu Ghraib. We've seen, actually, that some brave men and some women at Abu Ghraib have indeed reported what happened. They, like John Kerry, risked personal sacrifice, risked going to jail for war crimes to report what happened to their superiors. But when you're making the argument that this is actually top-down, that the top is ordering these war crimes, ordering these horrible things, you really put the list of men in catch-22. If you say nothing, well, you're complicit, right? And if you say something, well, then you're not only complicit, but you're unpatriotic. Not only should you go to jail for committing these war crimes, but you're unpatriotic. And that's exactly the argument that John O'Neill makes against John Kerry. He says, look, these war crimes are being used as justification by Hanoi. Hanoi is the capital of North Vietnam. In other words, the enemy is using, John Kerry, your statements of war crimes to justify the war. You are serving Hanoi's purposes, John O'Neill says. He says you don't do it intentionally, but you're helping the enemy by telling the truth about what Americans were doing in Vietnam. And then all this discussion of the deposition is the argument that John O'Neill's making, hey, if these things are true, why don't people come forward? John Kerry's saying they know if they come forward, they will be prosecuted. And our goal, John Kerry says, is not to prosecute the low-level people, which, remember, is exactly what Bush is doing at Abu Ghraib prison. he's prosecuting the very lowest of the low. People like Lindy England, a private from a reserve in West Virginia, who would serve 3 weeks, was sent to Iraq and ordered to do certain things. She followed orders. She's being prosecuted, but the person who gave the orders is not. John Kerry is saying we have to look at who gives the orders, not the people who follow the orders. So this, what's went on in this interview 33 years ago very much has resonance today. Think about how George Bush handles the Arub Garib scandal, prosecute the low levels, cover up the middle levels, deny the high levels, to how John Kerry would root out war crimes, would root out horrible events. And don't get lost in the name war crimes. As John Kerry points out, he's not talking about personal atrocities like cutting people's heads off, but free fire zones, shooting at anyone that moves, which John Kerry read the Geneva Conventions. It is against the Geneva Conventions. If we disagree with the conventions, we can change them, we can try not to sign them, we can modify them. But according to international law, these are war crimes, and that's the point that John Kerry is making. Again, it's a much more subtle, nuanced point than anything you will hear in the right-wing press. But that's why I wanted to play this tape for you. Let's listen to some more.
And the purpose of not signing them is literally to call for an examination of policy and not scapegoats, and to examine it from the President of the United States through General Westmoreland and others. And when they do that, then they will sign and then they will talk. Now, there are individuals who are perfectly willing to sign. Nobody's ducking anything. And
well, who are they? Tell me that.
Well, I have a friend who came all the way from Florida today, and if it's all right with you, he's here now. I'd be very happy to bring him on and let him make a deposition.
Well, I'd say just you and I have had the same experience.
Oh, you've asked for depositions.
Yeah, I'd like to see him sign a deposition after the show.
I think you've made a very, very serious charge.
That's absolutely correct, I have.
And there's a veteran here who's come all the way from Florida who, if you didn't mind, would come on television now with names, facts, dates, places, maps, coordinates, and he'd be very willing to make it public.
Two or three things to say. It's amazing. It certainly is wonderful that you finally produced somebody after 2 months. Second thing I have to say is the last time I came on this show, I appeared basically on a four-against-one form, and I'd prefer it one-to-one. But I'd certainly be interested in seeing him do that after this show, and I know the people of America would. It's interesting that you happen to say that you don't claim to speak for all veterans. You said before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, same testimony previously cited, I am here as one member of the group of 1,000. Which is a small representation of a very much larger group of veterans in this country. And were it possible for all of them to sit here at this table, they would be here and have the same kind of testimony. Well, and I'm here, John. I'm a veteran in this country. I'm here to say that's a lie.
Two quick points. One, on the deposition, as I said, people did not want to sign depositions. They're risking basically going to jail for signing them. John Kerry says, I'll present one. He's willing to come up on national television and say the war crimes that he saw. And John O'Neill backs down and says, I don't want him to come. He wants him to sign a deposition afterwards so he can prosecute him, but he doesn't want him to get the publicity that he would get by announcing the war crimes and talking about how they were ordered from the higher-ups. So that's what that little battle was about. Then he goes on to call John Kerry a liar when John Kerry simply made the point that his organization, there are more veterans other than those in his organization. In other words, he represents 1,000, and there are other veterans that also agree with him. He didn't claim to speak for all veterans, but he did claim there are more veterans than just those in his organization. Not exactly a lie here, and John Kerry respons.
Now, may I answer that, please?
You may, after this message, or we'll be in big trouble. We'll be right back for a local station. We are back.
I'd like to finish my statement, if I could, Mr. Cabot. I think that it's highly interesting that Mr. Kerry has finally produced one person to sign a deposition after 3 months of accusing 2.5 million of us of being war criminals. I suggest that if he produces another 400,000 or 500,000 depositions, then his charge might stand up. I think all he established, even if the deposition was correct, is that he has one war criminal that belongs to his organization. And that's kind of pathetic. Further, I'd like to go on.
Maybe he's done so much.
I'd like to go on and finish the... I served in Coastal Division...
It's easier if we don't jump into a second subject when one is on the table.
Well, as to my being a liar, I... In my testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I did indeed say what he said. I said I represent one of the group of 1,000, which incidentally was 1,000 at any one time. There were some 2,000 who came through the whole time we were in Washington. And when I referred to the very much larger group within the country, I referred to our membership of our organization. I didn't say a majority. I didn't say all veterans. I said to a very much larger group, which is the some 20,000 members that we have in the country at this particular moment. And that was my reference there. As to this question of who speaks for the majority and all this personal vindictiveness, I really think that that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about the question of this war and why it is continuing, why it's And I really don't think it does justice to those men who have to give up their lives or be maimed or something or in Vietnam now to have two veterans of the war sit here and go at each other's throats. I really think we can do better justice to the issue than that. And the issue really is, why can't we set a date? Mr. O'Neill has simply shrugged this off, saying that would be absurd. I want to know why we can't set a date when we know that the prisoners will come home, when we know that people will stop being maimed for the most senseless purpose in the world, and when we know that that, in fact, can be a solution and release the forces of accommodation in Vietnam, which will not be released as long as we are there and as long as we are helping the South Vietnamese.
I'd certainly like to talk on setting a date, but I suggest that we keep talking about the same two issues we have on the table. Once again, from Mr. Kerry's testimony, that same committee was written, I understand, by Adam Malinsky, your friend. It's interesting to see somebody that has a friend write about his experiences in Vietnam. I wouldn't...
How do you know that?
He says...
Wait. How do you know that?
Well, Mr. Walensky admitted it in the... In Human Events, also in the Boston Globe. I have
Did you read Mr. Walensky's letter yesterday,
said he
Leonard
be...
Lyons?
No,
Did
I didn't.
Did you read his letter?
I'd like to finish
May I quote
with
his
your...
letter? No, may
I'd like to quote your speech, if that's satisfactory.
Now, wait, you've just
says,
made
the
a charge.
The country does not know it yet, but it has created a monster in the form of millions of men who have been taught to deal and trade in violence, who have returned with a sense of anger and a sense of betrayal which no one has yet grasped. I suggest Mr. Kerry is trying to talk for something more than his little group of 20,000. I suggest he was attempting to represent himself as representative of all of us. Second, on the war crimes issue...
Well, wait a minute. We're way past the thing there.
I'd like
about
to...
whether or not your speeches were written for you or
well,
whether
I'm
or not...
One child, the group has suddenly jumped to 20,000 in the period of this.
Whose group has jumped to 20,000? Your group has, you mean? Or?
The Vietnam Veterans Against the War. 2 days ago in Leonard Lyons in New York, as a matter of fact, in answer to a charge made by the Vice President of the United States saying a Robert Kennedy speechwriter had written my speech, I would be flattered to have one write my speech, frankly, but in this letter he wrote to the Vice President saying, "Dear Mr. Vice President, thank you very much for insinuating I wrote John Kerry's speech. I would have been proud to have done it, but I didn't. However, in the future, please be sure to mention my name, as it will, as it is sure to help me in my next election." No, Adam Walensky did not submit a draft to me, and he did not write my speech. Now, as to the question...
Didn't say that, John. If I can quote Human Events, May 22nd, 1971...
Can we move...
I'd like to establish this point. Former Robert F. Kennedy staffer Adam Walensky acknowledged he had helped Kerry put together his eloquent presentation. Walensky said that Kerry, the 1966 Yale class orator, was pretty darn good with words all by himself, but added he had a hand in drafting those parts of the Kerry address which were on television. I think this is a relatively minor point. It's your speech I disagree with, not with who wrote it. My understanding is that's what he's told a number of people. The same story has appeared over and over. I think even more important is this point. You happen to feel that you're being vilified. I think you can imagine how the 2.5 million of us whom you have vilified feel at this time.
You're speaking for 2.5 million.
I'm speaking for myself.
You're speaking for 2.5 million.
I'd say, John, if you polled the American people instead of taking 75, polled the veterans in this country, instead of taking 75 to Bunker Hill, and you asked them the question, do you consider yourself war criminals, you'd find out that I was speaking to very close to 2.5 million.
That's very, very interesting. You're speaking for most of the guys in your division and everything else. They feel this way, you think?
I'd say that most of the veterans I have met in this guy, I'm aware that you did solicit virtually everybody from Coastal Division 11. I had people call me from all over the country whom you had called. You have financial resources above and beyond ours, and I don't know what results you happen to get. You might tell me how many people did you get from Coastal Division 11?
I didn't reach any, Mr. O'Neill, because I didn't call any personally and talk to any. However, apparently, I do have some friends who came back who did.
Apparently, the members of your organization did.
Well, it's very strange. You see, I received a letter from one of them, prompt two, that said, "Dear John, about John O'Neill, I can't understand how he could possibly represent any majority whatsoever." And this is from somebody who served in your division with you at the same time, in fact, who turned over the last vote to the Vietnamese.
I should explain the background of this. There were 800 people that served in Coastal Division 11 over the course of the Vietnam War. I've received approximately 12 calls, furthest away being from Honolulu, from people that your organization has contacted. Now, if you happen to read one letter, all I can say, it's like your organization. Everybody knows about the 10% that don't get the word, and your 20,000 make up about 1/20 of the 10% that don't get the word.
Well, Dick, I really think that this is exactly the point that I'm trying to make, and that is that we have never purported to represent any majority, nor can Mr. O'Neill sit here and pretend to talk for 2.5 million. He can talk for himself. And I think that this contest is ludicrous, that the points to be discussed are the questions of the war, and that's the issue we should get to, and I'd like to talk about that in a rational discussion.
I suggest it is time to move on. I'd like to make one last point, if I could, but I think it's very essential to the American people's right to know and so on.
All right, but the world's favorite mother has some important news about bathtub safety. Watch. We'll be right back.
While Dick Cav is taking a break, I'm going to make a few comments myself. It's very interesting to see the tactics of John O'Neill here, because what it shows is that there's nothing new under the sun. What happened 33 years ago is still happening today. You find that he actually does something that a lot of people who disagree with me on this show, a lot of times they do that. They make a charge, a really pretty radical, extreme charge, and they quickly move on and try to change the subject to other things. And Dick Cavett, I think quite rightly, says to John O'Neill, "Wait, you made a charge. You charged that John Kerry didn't write his speech." And John Kerry produced a letter to show that, in fact, he did write his own speech. At which point, John O'Neill turns around and said, "I didn't say you didn't write your speech." That to me was very interesting, very Orwellian. Makes a charge, "You didn't write your speech." Kerry proves he did, and then he comes back and says, "Well, I never made the charge I just made a minute earlier." That's a sign of someone who's really stretching. Just like when he says, "You solicited people," and then Kerry says that he didn't. He said, "Okay, well, your organization solicits people." This is someone who's playing fast and loose with the truth. But what's more interesting to me in all of this, when you think about it, is that, think about what he accuses Kerry of, okay? He accuses Kerry of not writing his own speech. He accuses Kerry of soliciting people, actually trying to get people to join his organization. Those are the biggest lies, and there happen to be lies, and Kerry shows them to be lies, and he backs down. But those are the biggest lies he can find. He doesn't charge Kerry. He doesn't charge Kerry with lack of heroism. He doesn't charge Kerry with making up events to lead to his Bronze Star and Silver Star. Here he is coming up with the strongest personal attacks he can find against Kerry. And what are they? "You didn't write your own speech. You solicited people for your organization." Don't you think if John O'Neill had any evidence, and clearly he'd been trained by Richard Nixon, he had all these veterans that disagreed with John Kerry coming back and opposing the war, which, by the way, I want to make clear, there's nothing wrong with John O'Neill disagreeing with John Kerry about the war. I think Kerry was right. Other people might think O'Neill was right. He has a right to be angry about John Kerry's allegations. That's what freedom and debate is all about. But these personal attacks that he comes up with, those are the things that are out of line. And what's interesting is that he has no personal attack that John Kerry wasn't a hero. Those personal attacks would come 33 years later in the book that he just wrote that's a bestseller on Amazon. That's why it's very important to get the context here. If he, with Richard, the President of the United States' help, was looking to slime John Kerry and all they could think about was maybe he didn't write his own speech, nothing at all challenging his heroism. And now 33 years later, these charges are first aired. This is smear politics of the highest order. John O'Neill passionately believes that John Kerry was wrong in the Vietnam War. Fine. That's a fine debate. It's an interesting debate. historically and for other reasons, and it's a good one to have, to listen to. You can make that argument today. But the personal attacks show where they really go beyond. He's not winning the audience, John O'Neill. John Kerry's winning the audience, and so John O'Neill is trying to resort to personal attack after personal attack. And what shows is that 33 years later, this man hasn't changed very much at all. As one of my listeners said, he's not near as good looking as he used to be 33 years ago, but his attack politics have remained the same. Let's go on to coming back from commercial and hear more of this interview, June 30th, 1971. If you want to call in, we will take your calls. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, toll-free 877-57-SCOOP. You'll be able to hear the program while you listen on the phone, so you won't miss anything. And then when we come to a break, I will take your calls. Let's hear more. The program is about half over now. Let's hear more from the Dick Cavett Show.
Lori's seasoned salt. It's great on all kinds of meat, on salads, and on chicken, too. Now,
I can certainly see Mr. Carey's reticence to discuss those issues, and I do agree the war is a very important issue, and I think it's a shame that he and his organization couldn't have been discussing just the war, had their own viewpoint in that all the way along the line. I think what is particularly pathetic, the fact, number one, that they attempted to speak for all veterans, which is clearly on the record, and fact number two, and if we've accomplished nothing else, at least we've stopped that, and fact number two, if they purported to represent all of us as war criminals, and I guess we've accomplished that also. I'd like to make one last point.
We've all heard the phrase, your organization, enough, probably. We'll probably hear it again tonight. I think it's obvious that nobody, either of you, can speak for all veterans, and I hope we would agree on that, because these are not the only possible reactions to the war. So maybe it would be well if we reduced the personal animosity between the two organizations and talked about some of the issues. Did you both start out to be career naval officers, each of you? As I understand, you did, and yet you're not in the Navy now.
No, I went to the Naval Academy, and I always figured, Mr. Cavett, that I would give the Navy an honest try. And after being in Vietnam for almost 3 years, I decided I wanted to go home, back to Texas. I would like to stay on this issue just a little bit longer, because I think there are some essential things the American people should know. There have been 6 nationwide television shows, CBS Face the Nation, CBS 60 Minutes, NBC Today Show, National Educational Television, Metro Media, NBC Comment, a number of other shows that have asked Mr. Carey and I to appear on them for a face-to-face stand-up debate, and he's rejected all of those offers. In doing so, I think that he's hurt the American public's right to know. Right to hear a dialogue instead of a monologue. I think that's another very essential point.
This question of equal time perturbs me, because two presidents have been speaking for the war for the last 8 years, and I really don't think it's as though people haven't had the other side. I'd like to move on to the question of we've had some very serious things raised here tonight, and I'd really like to discuss the issues that are at hand. And I think the American people deserve a little more depth on the question of the war itself at this point. Whether or not the group on the other side knows it or not, in fact, they should change their name from Vietnam Veterans for Just Peace to Vietnam Veterans for a Continued War, because that, in fact, is really what Vietnamization is. It is nothing more than a way of getting the United States out of Vietnam by changing the colors of the bodies in that country. It's a military solution in a problem that requires a very, very sophisticated political solution. And all that it will do in the end is possibly intricate us into a much, much deeper war than we are in now, or at least allow us to withdraw in time for the elections of next year, when the president can say, yes, indeed, we did withdraw, at which time more Americans will have lost their lives and more Vietnamese will have lost their lives needlessly. Now, when we talk about something like war crimes, we're not throwing this term out lightly. The Hague Convention, the Geneva Conventions, history has laid down certain laws of warfare. Hague Convention, I believe, Article 4, states that you are not allowed to bombard uninhabited villages or villages that are not occupied by defendants. We have done that constantly in Vietnam.
You've served in the same unit as I did, John. Can you tell me about any war crimes that occurred in that unit, Coastal Division 11? And a second question, why didn't you attempt to get out of the unit or submit a request when you were there if you saw anything that shocked a normal man?
I'll come back to the question.
I'd like you to answer that question if you would. We served up. You obviously are quite good on the polished rhetoric, but I did serve in the same place you did, and not for 4 months, but for 18 months, and I never saw anything, and I'd like you to tell me about the war crimes you saw committed there and also why you didn't do something about them, although you were there at a different time.
Did you serve in a free fire zone?
I certainly did serve in free fire zone.
Free fire zone, in which we kill anything that moves, man, woman, or child. This practice suspends the distinction between combatant and non-combatant and contravenes Geneva Convention on Article 3.1.
Where is that war crime from, John?
Geneva Convention. You've heard of
it. Oh, I am. I suggest.
May I complete my statement?
Sure,
for once
go ahead.
This evening, thank you.
Before John Kerry completes his statement, I do think it's important to talk about what just happened there. John Kerry's trying to talk about the war. He's trying to talk about what we should do now. He's trying to talk in depth with nuance, right? This is the guy. Again, compare him to George W. Bush. Think about the kind of person John Kerry is. He wants to talk in detail, how to get us out. He points out that sometimes the best way out of a military debacle is a sophisticated political solution. John O'Neill won't take that. He doesn't want to debate the issues. That's not his goal. His goal is to make John Kerry look bad. His goal is to go on the personal attack. He may know in the back of his mind that he can't debate John Kerry on the issues, on the issue of Vietnam, and so he's got to go to a personal attack. And it looks like all of you are following along really nicely. I want to read some of the quotes already that I've gotten on my blog. James writes, I don't know if you have it or not, Mark, but there's a great quote from Nixon about Kerry. Good stuff. They actually go get O'Neill because Kerry was really stirring things up, and unlike a lot of the other protesters, was clean-cut and articulate. I don't have that. In fact, James, if you want to find that and submit it on the blog, that would be great. I don't have the quote, but I do know there's no question that Richard Nixon did hire O'Neill to go out there and get Kerry. And again, this is Richard Nixon attack politics. The irony, again, is there's nothing new under the sun. Richard Nixon attack politics. Go, you can't fight Kerry on the merits. You can't fight on what he's saying. Go attack him personally. And so he hires O'Neill as his hitman to attack him personally. There's the comment by Marmaduke, writes, I think O'Neill begrudges Kerry for aging so well. I saw O'Neill on The Factor last night. His head and face looked like one giant meatball. That's my two cents. Well, Marmaduke, you're right. He definitely was a lot better looking at age 25 than he is today. Rick writes, this interview shows that Kerry has class and honor. This O'Neill guy, Rick gets the name wrong, it's O'Neill. This O'Neill guy is a punk. All he can bring is really lame personal attacks, which resembles the shallow and petty attacks the Republicans make today. Kerry is obviously more intelligent, or just a bit more secure in his facts. Gordon from Michigan writes that the idea of war crimes, that there's actually a group karma here. None of the combatants are innocent when war crimes are committed. And in fact, 30 years later, Gordon points out, reminds us that 58,000 U.S. Vietnam vets have committed suicide. 58,000, he says, citing a 95 PBS documentary, Letters from Vietnam. That matches the figure, Gordon points out, of those actually killed in combat. 50-some-odd thousand killed in combat, 50-some-odd thousand that have committed suicide. Gordon, I had not heard that fact. Thank you for pointing that out. But Gordon says there's actually enough damage from that war to have two big black walls and still more guilt floating around in those U.S. Viet vets still alive. Well, it's very hard for people to admit the awful things they've done. And it's very interesting. John Kerry, I think, acquits himself very well in this debate. John O'Neill is trying to make the debate personal. He's saying, John Kerry, did you commit war crimes? And that's obviously, it's like a question, you know, have you stopped beating your wife? The impossible question. Yes, I stopped beating my wife. Oh, you used to beat your wife. No, I haven't stopped. That's worse. Think about John O'Neill's question. John Kerry, did you commit war crimes? If John Kerry says, yes, I committed war crimes, John O'Neill says, you're a war criminal. You're an awful human being. You know, you have no one can believe what you say. And if John Kerry says, no, I didn't commit war crimes, then John O'Neill can say, see, you're just like all the others. You accuse everyone of committing war crimes, but you didn't see anything committed, so you're a liar. John O'Neill in the classic Nixonian question, has John Kerry? He's going to say, John Kerry, if you say yes, you committed war crimes, you're in trouble because you're a war criminal. And no, if you didn't, you're in trouble because you're a liar. Note how Kerry gets out from it. He says, well, I was in free fire zones. Were you in free fire zones? John O'Neill takes the bait. He says, yes, I was in free fire zones. Then John Kerry reads from the Geneva Convention, which says that a free fire zone where you shoot at anyone that moves, combatant or non-combatant, which obviously, according to John Kerry and John O'Neill, both men were ordered to do. Both men were ordered to shoot in free fire zones. Both men admitted they do it, and John Kerry points out that he didn't know it at the time, but he came back, read the Geneva Conventions, and found out that that is a war crime under international law. You're not allowed under Geneva Conventions to shoot at anything that moves. So he took this very difficult question, this impossible question, he turned it around and said, basically, John O'Neill, if you call me John Kerry a war criminal, then it's quite clear that you are one too. And the goal is not to attack all the veterans. My goal is not to insult all of them by calling them war criminals. As much as you can blame the grunts at the lower levels, and to some extent you can. Gordon from Michigan clearly understands there's some guilt. But clearly the much higher guilt is those that ordered the crimes, up to the President of the United States himself. That's what Kerry's point is. That's why he doesn't want to prosecute lower-level people. He wants to go to the very top, and that's what John O'Neill very desperately wants to prevent, because his benefactor, Richard Nixon, wants to protect against it. So really, I hope you caught the incredible drama of what just happened there. And the audience seems to get it. The audience, which at the beginning was sort of evenly split between the two men, definitely seems to be following John Kerry now. Let's hear more.
Yes, we did participate in war crimes in Coastal Division 11 because, as I said earlier, we took part in free fire zones, harassment, interdiction, fire, and search and destroy missions. The concept of operations, I gather, changed somewhat from the time when I was there and the time when you were there later on. And I believe that we moved into operations called Silver Mace 2 and some others in which we were not quite involved in this. But I know that there's no way in the world you can say that you didn't drive through the Kualan River or the Bodie River and see huts along the sides of the rivers that were totally destroyed. Did you see them destroyed? Were they destroyed?
May I answer the question?
Yes, were they destroyed?
I'd like to answer that question very fully. On the on those particular raids, as you and I both know, John.
How do you know?
From
were
the
you on
time,
them? Were you on them?
Yes, I was on the other
sea lords.
Side. Absolutely correct. I
sea lords
won.
Raids.
That's absolutely correct.
And you never burned a village.
I'd like to continue with my statement, if I may. I never burned a village. That's absolutely correct. On those particular raids, as you know, from the time you came into the Kualan River to the time you left the Bowday, you were receiving almost continuous fire the entire time. If you went on a little further, and I had the experience of being there after you, which is...
Stop. Did you catch that? Did you catch that? John O'Neill said 33 years ago, you were receiving almost continuous fire the whole time. The whole basis for John O'Neill's screed, his book, his smear attack against John Kerry, 33 years later, is that they weren't receiving fire. He has people signing affidavits that they weren't receiving enemy fire. And now John O'Neill has admitted, just a few months after the fact, when it's fresh in his mind, they were constantly receiving enemy fire. Now that's really interesting, because the press hasn't picked up on this. He admits, a few months later, after it occurs, they were almost continuously receiving enemy fire, then writes a book 33 years later, challenging John Kerry's heroism, because they weren't receiving enemy fire, and basically just says John Kerry pulled a guy off the boat, but wasn't being fired at the same time. Again, I'm not challenging John O'Neill's right to disagree with John Kerry on the war in Vietnam. It's a fascinating discussion. It's fascinating for American foreign policy. It's fascinating for history buffs like myself. But what you notice is that mixed in this interesting political discussion is the anatomy of a smear. This is a guy who knows how to do smears. And he takes one lie, and he changes his story 33 years later. And it just shows really how desperate this man is, this man who's out to destroy John Kerry, who's basically made a life career out of being John Kerry's nemesis. Let's continue.
Fortunate, you would have seen that right there on the Kualan River at the present time, there's a village of 10,000 people that came out from that entire area, refugees not from us, but refugees from the Viet Cong, people who came there just to have their own type of government and just to be free. And I think we all realize that as honorable men, we'd never I don't know the semantics perhaps as well as you, but we all realize that we'd never do anything dishonorable. And I think that you must realize that you would have done something about it then. I think it was only the fact that a fellow changes when he runs for congressman from Massachusetts. That's what's accounts for your particular change.
Note the accusation of a flip-flop.
If I can... First of all, we did...
Excuse me, Joe, you may answer those after this commercial from a car with 25 years of improvement. We're back, and two of the charges against John Kerry at the moment that I remember are why didn't he leave when war crimes were being committed in front of him. And I'm going to finish this sentence, and...
To get a mild-mannered man like Dick Cavett upset at John O'Neill is pretty extraordinary. He's been very much out of the debate, but he wants to take control of his own show, which he said very little. I just thought that was an interesting exchange. Let's keep going.
And has your attitude changed because of your political ambitions? Those are two things that were mentioned.
Well, I hardly think the second really merits that much discussion or consideration. The fact of the matter is that the members of Coastal Division 11 and Coastal Division 13, when I was in Vietnam, were fighting the policy very, very hard, to the point that many of the members were refusing to carry out orders on some of their missions, to the point where the crews started to, in fact, mutiny, say, I would not go back in the rivers again, the point where my commanding officer was relieved of duty because he pressed our objections to what we were doing with the captain in command of the entire operation.
The man above you was relieved of duty.
That is correct. The man above me was finally relieved of duty, to the point that we had a continual rotation going on of new officers coming from the divisions that were not in this to try and replenish our spirit, to the point that the commanding admiral of all forces in Vietnam and General Abrams himself flew us to Saigon, completely stopped the war, put us in an airplane, we put on our khakis and went up there, and were briefed for an entire day and told how what we were doing was writing Navy legends and how we were writing a new kind of history in the war, and so on and so on. And then we returned to go back into the rivers to do the same thing. The fact of the matter remains that after I received my third wound and was told that I could return to the United States, I deliberated for about 2 weeks because there was a very difficult decision in whether or not you leave your friends because you have an opportunity to go. But I finally made the decision to go back and did leave of my own volition because I felt that I could do more against the war back here. And when I got back here, I was serving as an aide to an admiral in New York City, and I wrote a letter through him requesting that I be released from the Navy early because of my opposition, and I was granted that release, and I've been working against the war ever since then.
Now, there are a lot of important things there. This is very important. Anytime your Republican friend says, John Kerry says he's a war criminal, let's talk about what John Kerry did, because he really went beyond the duty. What do you do if you're a soldier and you're ordered to commit a war crime? What do you do? Well, here's what John Kerry said he did. They were fighting the orders. Many of the men were refusing to carry out the orders. Now, think about what this means. I mean, talk about a catch-22. If you don't follow the orders, you can be, tried. The military orders you to do something. That's insubordination. But he says many of his men were refusing to carry out the orders, starting to mutiny, he says. In fact, his commanding officer, who was sympathetic to the men that refused to commit these war crimes, that they pressed him to press his objections with his higher-ups. And this commanding officer went to the captain, said the men did not want to do these acts, and the captain removed him. The higher-ups removed the people complaining about the war crimes. That's very important. Kerry also talks about that morale was so low that the head of the whole thing in Vietnam, the whole war, General Abrams, the commanding general, stopped the war, sent all the troops over for a day for basically a morale-building session to try to convince them to stay in, to say they were writing Navy legends. So, you see, the Republicans are trying to put, and they've tried for 33 years, to put John Kerry in a catch-22. If you didn't commit war, you say war crimes were committed, we'd rather you keep quiet. Just like those people that committed torture in Abu Ghraib, if you see something wrong, if you see a horror, you better keep quiet. Don't say when Americans are doing wrong, we're going to accuse you of being against America, anti-American, unpatriotic, of helping the enemy. And if you try to finger your higher-ups and say your higher-ups ordered these things, we're going to go out after you. When you are a war criminal, what are you going to say? I'm a war criminal? Then we'll prosecute you. What are you going to say? I'm not a war criminal? Then you have no credibility. And it's the great way to fight. If you're a general and you want to commit all-out war, you want to drop bombs on a country that hasn't attacked us like Cambodia or Laos, you want to torture people at Abu Ghraib prison, you want to mistreat people, do free fire zones, really don't give a damn about the Geneva Conventions and just want to torture people in all-out war, and you want to keep it secret, all you have to do is go after people like John O'Neill goes after John Kerry. Aha! Aha! You're a war criminal. But John Kerry one-upped him. He trumped him. He said, no, we did try to fight it. The men were practically mutinying. They were refusing to serve on the boats. They pressed their commanding officer, and he was removed because of their complaints. In other words, John Kerry went above and beyond. He not only served his country when orders were given, he served higher than that. He served our higher moral calling. He recognized that a good soldier doesn't only follow orders, though he does most of the time, but he recognizes when orders themselves are immoral. Recognizes when you're ordered to do a war crimes, you complain about it. You don't just follow orders. That, to me, shows an incredible understanding and, frankly, a man who would be an incredible president of the United States. A true leader understands you don't just follow along. You don't just sit there and read My Pet Goat because your advisors want you to stay still or haven't told you what to do. A true leader thinks beyond the orders, thinks beyond it and says, now wait a minute, I was ordered to do it, but is it right? And that's why these allegations that John Kerry said that his unit committed some war crimes, which the Republicans are trying to use very much in spin, you know, sound bites and in spin to attack John Kerry, when you hear it in the full context, you can actually see that he is much braver than your ordinary, even the ordinary guy that goes to Vietnam. Again, you know, our current president not only refused to go to Vietnam and went in a champagne unit of the National Guard, he didn't even show up there because he was high all the time. This is a guy who not only went to Vietnam, even though he opposed the war, but questioned whether we should be doing some of the awful things we did in Vietnam. This, to me, is a leader of a higher order, and this is something that's not easy to explain in 1 minute, and that's why I'm really glad to play you for the full hour. We've got about 20 minutes left of the program. I do think it's very interesting. The show will go over. We're going to go over until about 4:45. Listen in as the debate continues.
I don't think that it's a question of principles that change or of ideals or the fact that we didn't try and fight it over there. That's just not true at all. We did. The bigger issue at hand is the question, literally, of how the United States is going to get out of Vietnam now. And I have said again and again this evening that we can set a date, that we can bring the prisoners home. But the point is, I think this administration is still seeking some kind of victory over there. It is still committed to the idea, totally, of a non-communist regime. And I think that that's unrealistic in terms of the political forces that are at play in South Vietnam, in fact, in all of Southeast Asia. And we have learned, if we haven't learned anything by now, that we simply can't impose settlement on ourselves. I just don't understand how they believe, or how this other group believes, that the Vietnamese are going to succeed in doing with 50,000 Americans what they haven't been able to do with 500,000 Americans. And I'd like that explained.
Uh-huh. I'd like to respond to both of those points. The first point is, I served in Coastal Division 11 for 12 months, not 4. I never saw any moral protest there. I think that the story Mr. Kerry has told, if you take a look at it and talk to the people involved, including that admiral who is now the chief of naval operations, is in large measure prefabrication. The reason they were brought to Saigon wasn't, and here I'm not speaking from first-person knowledge, but there are a number of people I know that could. The reason they were brought there was because they had taken such severe casualties. And the great majority of people in that coastal division weren't opposed to the war. As I understand, Mr. Kerry's release from the Navy got it to run for Congress, which was his way against working, you know, against the war. He didn't go down and work at the polls like everybody else. He just ran for Congress. On the Vietnamization program of the president, I don't think there's any rational man in this country that believes we should have a military solution any longer to the Vietnam War. The people that escalated the war, as I've indicated, are the same people that are close friends of Mr. Curie at the present time. I think the point and partial and fact of the matter is that we never relied on the Vietnamese. We never armed them. We never had any strategy there until about 1968. We turned to Vietnamization. We gave them for the first time M-16s. We turned over a Navy to them. We gave them helicopters. And that as we've withdrawn, the truth is in the telling, is in what's happened. As we've withdrawn down to where we have one-third of the forces that we had there when Mr. Curie and I were there, the South Vietnamese still remain free. They've still inflicted severe casualties on the North Vietnamese wherever they've been attacked.
At this point, it's actually more of historical interest than character interest, but I think it's very interesting historically. Listen to John O'Neill's predictions about the Vietnam War. Virtually everyone he makes turns out to be wrong, and John Kerry turns out to be right. You know, you can't, when you make a prediction on tape, it's very dangerous because people can play it back later. Listen to John O'Neill's predictions and listen to John Kerry's.
Firebase Fuller being a classic example of it.
3 to 5 years from now, we will be out of there completely, and the South Vietnamese will be, there will be a non-communist South Vietnamese.
I think I agree with Mr. Curie. His innuendo, of course, is unique that somebody would withdraw in time for the election in order to win an election. Mr. Humphrey's already indicated his opinion of it. I think it's quite obvious that we're going to be out of there in terms of ground forces, in terms of almost everything within the next year and a half, that the way we're going to help them out is through giving them economic and military aid, which is the same thing the North Vietnamese received from the Chinese and from the Soviets at the present time.
Interruption. Local stations have a message. We'll be right back.
Quick comment on two predictions there. He said that it's extraordinary that John Kerry would suggest that the president might try to withdraw troops in time for the election. Indeed, Richard Nixon did, 1972, right before the election, announced that they had made a deal and the entire Vietnam situation was solved. Of course, it really wasn't until 75 when the North Vietnamese won the war entirely. He also said the troops would be out in a year and a half. That prediction also was wrong. Let's listen in to, but just it's important because we have our own president, for example, trying very interestingly to put off the Iraq election until after our election because he didn't want those results to be seen, which are very bad. But let's go on and hear more from the show. While they're playing music, I should say that if you want to see this entire thing, it's on C-SPAN, and you can watch the expressions, but I really think it plays just as well on radio.
Time is really racing by, and we want to talk about the issues. I don't have a suggestion as to which one you would like to discuss right at the moment.
Well, there was an allusion there that I was just making innuendo, I think, on the question of this election thing. And I'm trying to impress the fact that we're saying from fact. United States Senator Robert Griffin had the following comment on Nixon's report to the nation of April 7, 1971. He said, "It was a sincere, credible, and courageous speech infusing new strength and character into the American spirit. In a practical sense, he did set a date certain for ending United States involvement, Election Day, 1972. Then later, Senator Scott said, in answer to a question, what about the date, Scott said he believed it would be before the end of 1972, adding that if the war drags on beyond that point, quote, another man may be standing on the platform when the next president is inaugurated in January 1973. So I think it's very clear that if the Senate whip and the Senate minority leader both have this opinion, that is not innuendo. The point is that there is a timetable. There is very definitely a timetable. But that timetable is not going to bring the prisoners of war home. As long as there is no negotiated settlement in this war, those prisoners will stay in Hanoi. And we have no bartering position because the president, on the other hand, has said that he is pulling the number of troops down. And each day that he pulls out more troops, he loses whatever bargaining position there is. Secondly, we are killing more Americans needlessly. If, in fact, we have stated that we do have a date certain, even if it hasn't been put out in front of the people, then some American is going to be killed and is going to be the last guy to die for an admitted mistake. Now, I don't think that's right.
That does seem to be a central issue here. There was an interview with, let me just state this, with some women last night on CBS whose husbands were over there, and they were saying, we of course supported the president because we're military wise and so on, but it's pretty hard now when people are back, when we're supposedly backing out of this war, to rationalize the fact that our husbands are still prisoners and that our sons are still dying.
I suggest it all comes in terms of an understanding of the issue, sir. We no longer obviously plan to win a military victory there. I think that all we've done is redefine, or actually accomplish a reasonable definition of victory, which is giving the South Vietnamese the arms and tools to defend themselves. And I think that under the Vietnamization program, that's precisely and exactly what we've accomplished. I find it particularly remarkable that this gentleman, who is building his political career, apparently, upon the misery of all of us that serve there, for him to libel by innuendo the President of the United States and to suggest that he's keeping people there any longer than they have to be for political reasons. I think that's a particularly remarkable thing to have happen.
Well, Dick, I think that the question comes down to this, that really one could debate for a long time whether or not Vietnamization is working. As a matter of fact, just the other day, a United States colonel with two Distinguished Service Crosses, 9 Silver Stars, 9 Bronze Stars, 8 Purple Hearts, who was the senior advisor to the airborne during the Cambodian invasion, who's commanded 2 combat battalions in Vietnam, who was the deputy assistant advisor in the Highlands, and who just completed 1 year as senior advisor in the Mekong Delta, threw away his career, quit the United States Army, saying that Vietnamization was a Madison Avenue man's dream. Now, I think that you could go on and on. The point is, I'm not trying to say conclusively that proves it's not working. One could debate that forever. The greater issue is this, that as long as the United States has some kind of troops in Vietnam, and it's been proven, and the president has not said all will come home, and the Secretary of State has said in his last press conference that we will have a residual force, as long as that residual force is in Southeast Asia, they will be attacked, they will be harassed, they will be mortared, there will be confrontation. And as long as there is confrontation, the United States of America will be called on to react. And we have not yet said what that reaction will be. Secondly, as long as you do not settle the political question of how the Vietnamese communists are going to fit into some kind of regime, as long as you continue the hypocrisy of saying that we are fighting for a democracy when you have a regime which only recently passed a law which may not let them have other candidates in an election, to 100,000 to 200,000 political prisoners in jail, which 14 days ago closed down, 10 days ago closed down 14 newspapers because they printed Key's speech about the corruption of the government. As long as we're supporting this kind of government and doesn't allow representative forces to be part of it, you are asking for trouble. That's what we're doing.
Now, that's a really important point there, right? I mean, understand, this is very important to understanding Kerry's worldview. He's saying, why are we losing the war in South Vietnam? It's not because we don't have enough military power. We actually dropped more bombs on Vietnam than the entire course of World War II. Why is it that we're losing? We're losing because we have the hypocrisy of claiming that we're there for democracy when instead we're supporting a regime that allows no other candidates to run, that has 100,000 to 200,000 political prisoners in jail, where 14 newspapers get shut down because they try to report corruption. It seems to me that this is a worldview that Kerry had then and continues to have now, and one that really would change, talk about change the world, really change the world. I don't see John Kerry as supporting the Saudi royal family like George Bush or the dictators of Equatorial Guinea or Gabon just to get oil, or for that matter, Saddam Hussein. Remember, the neocons loved Saddam Hussein when he was selling us oil. George H.W. Bush liked him. Ronald Reagan liked him. Dick Cheney, as head of Halliburton, sold him oil equipment well into the 1990s. So, you know, John Kerry is saying, look, we have to look at our moral values. And we can't be fighting for democracy when we're fighting for a regime that's not democratic. And then when you think about the fact that Bush has installed the Iraqi leaders, it makes you wonder. It makes you wonder, what are we fighting for in Iraq? Are we fighting for democracy? Are we fighting for the right to control Iraq's government? Bush has conveniently left the election in Iraq until after the election in November. But it strikes me that the neocons really want to control Iraq. They don't want Iraqi democracy. And Kerry's pointing out that when you don't have a democracy, it's very hard to fight for democracy. And again, I think it's a very, very important point. Let's go on to the show.
I suggest, Mr. Cabot.
You have to answer that after this message. We have a message. We'll be right back. Comes right now. We were talking about the hopes or lack of them for Vietnamization working.
I'd like to respond to what Mr. Carey said. First of all, he quoted one colonel that suffers from the same problem as his organization did when the press covered 75 veterans out of 2.5 million of us. Obviously, you could talk to many thousands of other colonels who are serving in Vietnam that feel differently. That colonel happened to serve in the Mekong Delta. He managed one small area, province there. I can quote from the gentleman who runs the pacification program.
John, you didn't hear me correctly. I said he commanded two combat battalions.
He had a large amount of experience at the present time. I understand he's in charge of a province, isn't he, in the Mekong Delta?
But his overall experience
certainly
count.
Yeah, well, this gentleman has been there for... No, I think it counts for a considerable amount, John, and I respect his opinion. It's just a shame the other 10,000 or so haven't appeared. This is the fellow, John Paul Vann, who's the director of that entire region. He's a civilian, used to be director until May 16th. He had this to say. He says that we're dealing with an enemy who's been actively engaging and attempting to impose his will upon the population for decades. The government control, however, of the Delta has gone from 3 million to 5.8 million. He says because of the Tet Offensive and so on that the population has shifted against the Viet Cong in that area. And I noticed the same thing from my own observations. Units like the U Minh 2nd Battalion, the To Chau Battalion and so on are no longer exist. They were formerly the prime Viet Cong units in the area. A second point I'd like to make is on political settlement. It seems to me that our position is the most unambiguous possible. Withdraw all North Vietnamese forces, withdraw all U.S. and allied forces, let the South Vietnamese themselves have a free election with almost anybody supervising it. The Swiss, the Swedes, the United Nations, anybody else. That's the legitimate way to incorporate other forces into the government. Finally, on a residual force, we're only going to keep a residual force there until our POWs are returned. If we immediately withdraw from Vietnam, as John suggested, it's a very serious situation either way. But if we immediately withdraw, what sort of a bargaining counter do we have? All the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese have said is that they'll negotiate with us if we totally withdraw. We've been negotiating for 3 years or more in this country. They're not the kind of people I don't think that you're going to get too far with.
I'd like to come back to that again. I keep making the point. Many people have made it. Clark Clifford, former Secretary of Defense, has made it. The newspapers have all made this point, that the prisoners of war, the question will be settled. It's not a question of negotiations. They have said it will be settled. Now, if we were to set a date for withdrawal from Southeast Asia, we can... The Vietnamese, first of all, have said it will be settled prior to the arrival of that date. But we can set a time limit on that. If the prisoners of war aren't back prior to the arrival of that date, then I think we would have, for the first time in all of our history of Vietnam, we would have a legitimate reason for taking some kind of reaction to it. The point is, we can set a date, and they will be returned. A residual force is not going to return the prisoners if 500,000 people in the most devastating bombing in the history of warfare couldn't free them, or at least find a settlement in Southeast Asia. Secondly, to the question of Vietnamization, I keep saying, I'm not trying to prove it isn't going to work, and nor can it be proven that it can work. The question is it anything more than a military solution? Does it do anything more than continue a war? And that is, in fact, what we're doing. And that's, there is no such thing as a just or lasting peace in anything remotely resembling Vietnamization. And you can't call a continued war peace. It just doesn't work somehow.
I'd say that, obviously, it's interesting. First of all, John, you quoted Mr. Clark Clifford, who was so intimately connected, according to the Pentagon Papers, with our policy of escalation in Vietnam. I think it's quite evident that certainly our prisoners will be released. I'd suggest that if we got to the point where we had no one there, they'd be released under the following preconditions. It's been suggested a number of times. First of all, we'd pay reparations to the North Vietnamese. Second, we'd topple the Saigon government. And third, of course, we'd have to cease all aid to that government. I don't think the POWs, six of whom went to the Naval Academy in my class with me, would want us to do that. And to go on just a little bit further, I think it's quite evident that you'll reach a point in Vietnam when instead of facing Americans who are going to go home, you're going to be facing South Vietnamese who are never going. As a matter of fact, they are home right then. I think that the story of the last 2 years is that the war, that the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese effort in that country is less and less indigenous. And I think that at a certain point that the North Vietnamese will certainly realize the futility of our efforts. I admit both choices are bad. I just suggest that my choice is a better one than yours is. It's a better and surer way of getting the POWs back. I still don't understand why the prisoners will come back.
I'd
say that it is certainly our best hope of getting the prisoners back.
But we can guarantee them come back.
I suggest that if we reach a certain point, and we can't guarantee getting them back tomorrow. There's no one that has ever said that we'd get them back tomorrow if we withdrew from Vietnam. You can't believe that.
But it has been said very clearly.
Madam Vinh hasn't said it.
Madam Vinh doesn't hold the prisoners. San Tui does, and he said it.
They both hold a number of prisoners. As a matter of fact, we don't even know how many prisoners the Viet Cong and the Laotians and Cambodians have because they've never identified any of them. I would like to say this on Vietnamization. I think that it's quite evident under the Vietnamization program, under what's happened, that it is succeeding, that it does provide a viable political solution to the war. That's been the story of the last 3 years.
No one has said there'll be a bloodbath if we pull out, which is a cliche we used to hear a lot. Does either of you still think there would be?
I think if we pull out prematurely before a viable South Vietnamese government is established, that the record of the North Vietnamese in the past and the record of the Viet Cong and the area I served in at Operation Seafloat clearly indicates that's precisely what would happen in that country.
That's a guess, of course.
I'd say that their record at Wei, at Doc Son, at a lot of other places pretty clearly indicates that's precisely what happened. Obviously, at Wei, we've discovered how many, 5,700 graves so far, at Doc Son, 400 or 500.
The true fact of the matter is, Dick, that there's absolutely no guarantee that there would be a bloodbath. There's no guarantee that there wouldn't. One has to obviously conjecture on this. However, I think the arguments clearly indicate that there probably wouldn't be. First of all, if you read back historically, in 1950, the French made statements. There was a speech made by, I think it was General Leclerc, that if they pulled out, France pulled out, then there'd be a bloodbath. There wasn't a bloodbath. The same for Algeria. There hasn't been. I think that it's really kind of a baiting argument. There is no interest on the part of the North Vietnamese to try and massacre the people once people have agreed to withdraw. There's just no purpose. Now, I realize that there would be certain political assassinations, and that might take place. And I think when you balance that against the fact that the United States has now accounted for some 18,600 people through its own Phoenix program, which is a program of assassination, and when you balance that off against the morality of the kind of bombing we've been doing in Laos and the kind of destruction wholesale of the country of Vietnam, which amounts to some 155,000 civilians a year killed, then I think to talk about 4,000 or 5,000 people is lunacy in terms of the overall argument and what we're seeking in Southeast Asia.
I think that's a very highly spurious argument for the following reasons. First of all, after the North Vietnamese took over in North Vietnam in 1954, everybody knows about the bloodbath that occurred there, 50 to 60,000 estimated dead at that time. There were 1 million refugees that came south. As far as the bombing in Laos, it's highly interesting to note that occurs in the area of the Ho Chi Minh Trail primarily, where only 7,000 to 8,000 people live. It's true that there is a severe refugee problem. There are 700,000 refugees, for example, in Laos. There were 10,000 down at Seafloat. I suggest that all Mr. Kerry's program does, it stops the refugee problem, but it stops it by giving those people no place that they can possibly go to. I think there'd be a very severe bloodbath there.
We have a message. We'll be right back. Local station.
Dick Cavett's taking a break. There's only about 5 minutes left in the program. I do want to make a few comments. One, I was very impressed in this debate. And again, the debate at that time was about Vietnam. I'm obviously looking at it for things beyond Vietnam, for understanding of the character of the man that I hope and expect will be the next president of the United States. What's interesting to me is that John Kerry does not overstate his case. John O'Neill throughout the program overstates his case and has to back off. He says, you lied about, you wrote your speech, and then he backs off. You solicited people, and then he backs off. You said you're a war criminal, but I participated in free fire zones. He makes too strong a case, and then he has to back off. Kerry does not overstate his case, which I think makes him a lot more believable. Kerry says, look, I can't say whether there'll be a bloodbath or not. He doesn't say, no, there won't be a bloodbath. He says, I can't say. I can't predict the future. John O'Neill tries to predict the future, says there will be a bloodbath. Of course, in point of fact, there was none. When we pulled out from North Vietnam, there was no bloodbath. And John Kerry says, that's just a baiting argument. He says, but even though I can't predict it, let me give you my reasons why I think it's not likely there's one. He says, there'd be no interest on the North Vietnamese part once they've won to do a bloodbath. He does say there will be some 4,000 to 5,000 political assassinations. Now, that's really interesting. Kerry is giving up. He's giving up something that hurts his debating position. That, to me, is the sign of someone who's really thought about it. He's not just making his debate to make his debate, to win the debate. He is admitting the dangers of the course of action that he prescribes. He says there will be 4,000 or 5,000 political assassinations, and that's a bad thing. But compared to the 155,000 civilians we're killing each year, compared to the political assassinations that we have done, that is a bad consequence, but better than a continued war. This is the sign of a thinker. This is a sign of someone who's not just trying to win debating points, but is actually going out, considering all the possibilities and coming at the least bad solution. There are no great solutions. We're already in this mess. Again, think to what Kerry would do in Iraq. There are no great solutions. We're already in this mess. But how to get out in the way that saves the most lives and does so with American honor and respect for law. It's very, very interesting and very important that Kerry does not overstate his case. And you see how John O'Neill is very much attacking, and Kerry is very much saying, look, you know, when he gets, John O'Neill gets something wrong, he announces it is wrong. But otherwise, he just tells it like it is. And I was very impressed by his behavior throughout this, and by his saying basic things that we know, quote, you can't call a continued war a peace, unquote. That's what John Kerry said. You can't call a continued war a peace. Pretty basic, and yet we're starting to see in Iraq that's what's happening. Now, I do not mean to say Vietnam is Iraq. I do not mean to say there are immediate parallels. There are differences. There's the war on terror. Maybe we should be fighting. We did take out the government of Saddam Hussein. We're trying to reconstitute one. I'm not trying to say they're parallels. What I'm trying to understand from this hour on Dick Cavett that I found fascinating is not to refight the war in Vietnam, but to see who is this man, John Kerry. How does he respond under attack? Some men, some presidents, respond when they're under attack with fudging the evidence, with lying, with attacking your opponent personally, right? John Kerry did not attack John O'Neill personally. He did not fight back with an ad hominem attack. He responded, and he even admitted where he was wrong. He said, even admitted the negatives of his own position. He even admitted where we couldn't be sure. This is the kind of president I want, not someone who's trying to win a political battle. And clearly, it was very important to John Kerry to win that debate, to win a political battle. And yet, to me, he won the battle not by overstating the case, but in fact by understating the case. Before we get to the last 5 minutes, a number of you listeners have written about how it was Richard Nixon, as I said at the outset, that put John O'Neill up to it. James, in fact, has provided to me some quotes about it.